Taxation number 22099, Rule 3.
Captain David Render, Reel 2, Side 1. Okay, we're talking about your passing out from Sandhurst.
Mm-hmm. Well, I passed out, I think it would be in the April of 1944. And I would say that the training was, of course, as far as the guns and the wireless and the driving of the tanks, was very, very similar to the sort of training, naturally, of course, because we were using the same equipment, to the sort of training that we'd had in the earlier days at Bovington and so on. As far as the tactics were concerned, looking back on it, it was purely and simply a matter of that's how you fought the war. They didn't really, the people who were teaching us didn't really know enough about it, in my view. I don't think that any of them, and there were only a few who were on tactics, had necessarily been in action. I wouldn't like to say whether they had or they hadn't, but they certainly, thinking about it afterwards, I don't think knew the first thing about what it was like to actually fight a troop of tanks. Now, I would think that they took very, very seriously the sort of opposition that we were going to be up against. Bear in mind that I'm now telling you that it was a year and a half from being an ordinary civvy. Well, I wasn't quite, because I'd actually done Home Guard. I did miss that out earlier on. I did Home Guard service. But the point was that it was a year and a half to turn out a raw second lieutenant troop leader. Bear in mind that the war really only lasted 5 years, so I mean, if they were taking a year and a half to train up a tank troop leader, it shows you really what we were up against. The Germans were, of course, very, very carefully picked from the point of view of their tank crews and their tank commanders. They couldn't be a tank commander unless they'd done a certain number of actions. I think it was probably 5 or 6 actions. They certainly had to be in action before they were allowed to do it. It wasn't in our case at all. As I will tell you in a moment, we were 19 years old, don't forget now, and we were going to be in command of a troop of tanks, and as you'll hear again in a minute, how quickly that happened.
When you left Sandhurst, had you been trained in working with artillery and infantry and the other supporting arms? Had you had an exposure to
none
that?
None at all. None whatsoever.
Okay. Presumably when you left Sandhurst, you were cap badged to a certain regiment?
Or no.
Did you remain in the RAC?
Just RAC, yeah. Okay. And then I was sent up to a place called Reith in Lancashire. And I was there for about 2 months, I suppose. And one of the things they did with us, and I didn't understand what this was all about, they made us do a 110-mile march over the weekend. We were put in trucks, and we were driven down the coast and dropped off at intervals well away from each other with just a compass and a compass bearing and told to march on it. And this we did because it was out. Well, the thing was that we just had to march straight across the moors to get back to this Reith place. And, of course, one wonders why on earth we had to do that. I mean, I started off with boots with studs on. I mean, I'm a second lieutenant, by the way, now. And I wore the boot, wore the studs clean out and the leather, and I was down to my socks by the time I arrived on Monday morning. Well, of course, you see, I see what they were doing. I realised afterwards what they were doing. That was that if we got captured, then we would probably have to march miles. And it was their way of breaking us into such an idea.
And which, sorry, which unit was this in Reith?
Well, it wasn't a unit. It was like a holding unit.
Right.
I can't even remember what it was called. There were quite a few of us there, probably about 10 or 15 of us there.
And were you aware at this stage that the invasion was imminent?
No. No idea. It was all secret. No idea whatsoever.
So what did you think was going to happen to you once you'd been posted up there?
Didn't know.
Nobody had briefed you at any stage?
No briefing whatsoever.
So you were in Reith, and then presumably,
well,
you
one
were told
day an order came that I had to report to Southampton. I thought that I was going to get a leave or something, but no, nothing like that at all. We did sort of, it was like a holding regiment. We did a certain amount of drill. We did. We drilled people, we had to sort of generally do things, nothing in particular, but that's what Reith was all about. It was like a holding thing.
So when you were ordered to report to Southampton, did they tell you what you had to report there for?
No, I just had to report down to there and I would be met by somebody. What I was doing, I had no idea at all. And when I got to Southampton, this captain turned up in a jeep and he said, are you Render? So I said yes. So he said, right, get in the jeep. And we drove off, I don't know where, and we arrived in a field, and there were 16 Cromwell tanks standing in the field, and there was a number of men there, and this captain said to me, right, he said, you've got 16 tanks, he said, and there are 32 men. He said, get them waterproofed. So I said, well, hold on a minute, I don't know how to waterproof. What am I supposed to do? So he said, well, we've done one over there. He said, you'll find all the dens of tape and putty and everything else you want. He said, in those boxes over there by that one. And he said, we've done one. He said, you just follow that and do the same thing with the rest of them. So I said, oh, righto. And he said, right, you've got 2 days to do it in and make a good job of it. Well, I didn't quite realise why he said that, but anyway, the point is he did. So I said to myself, well, the best thing is to line them up. So I shouted out to one of them, said, right, form two ranks, you see, so they did. And I said, right, all drivers, one pace forward, you see. So with that, the whole lot stepped forward. So I said, well, in that case, the 16 of you are drivers, and the other 16 of you pair off. You can pair off and take a tank each, right. So they duly did. I was a bit nervous about all this, but still, nevertheless, it went all right. So they duly did, and I said, right, well, come on, we'll get waterproofing. Well, then I got one of the chaps, because we'd got no food or anything like that, no skip or anything, no sleeping arrangements, just our bedroll, because we used to take our own bedrolls with us. And so with that, I said, go and get some food. I don't care where you go, but get it, you see. So with that, he did, and he brought various bread and all the rest of it. And in the meantime, we got stuck in, you see. Well, obviously it got dark, so we kept down in and on the tanks. And then the next morning, we got going again. And then suddenly the jeep appeared with this captain on board. And he said, right, start the tanks up. He said, you're going. So I said, well, hold on a minute. I said, we haven't had our 2 days yet. He said, never mind that. He said, get in this bloody jeep and off we go. Start them up. So they started them up. Dropped everything, and we drove down the road. I don't know, again, quite where. Well, all of a sudden, we arrived at the dock, and standing there was a landing strip tank with the doors open. Right, he said, back the tanks in and hurry up. So I said, oh, all right then. So with that, we backed them in, and we had to chain them down. And while we'd done all this, nobody spoke to me at all. And by this time, of course, I'd got to know some of the chaps and was calling them by their various names, whatever they were. And I then said, well, you know, we've done the chaining down, we better get off, you see, and go back and get some more, I suppose. So, but there wasn't anybody about. And I happened to see a sailor chap there, a metal-eyed bloke, and I said to him, can you tell me where I go, where we get off, because, you know, we've done our job here. So he said, get off? He said, what are you talking about? So I said, well, you know, we've got to go back and get some more tanks. So he said, well, he said, I suggest you look out of that porthole over there, he said, and see what you can see. So I looked out and we were at sea. Now, I didn't realise the movement of the ship was nothing in particular, you see. So I hadn't a clue. Nobody told us anything.
Were you aware that the invasion had taken place?
No.
At the stage?
Didn't know.
Right.
I hadn't got a clue. No clue. We weren't in contact with anybody. Typical. Didn't tell you anything. So anyway, I said, well, I don't know, what am I supposed to do here? So anyway, I then ferreted about and I came across a naval officer, you see, and I said to him, look, I'm on the thing here. And I said, and I don't know, can we have some food? Because I said, our chaps. And I said, no, I didn't realise we were at sea. I mean, where are we going? What's going on? So he said, oh, well, all right. He said, I'll arrange for the blokes to have some food in the mess, you see. So he said, well, you better follow me, you see. So I went with him and we went into this cabin, wherever, in this mess room. And food was served up okay with the other officers and so on. But they didn't want to talk to me at all, not in the slightest. And as far as the men were concerned, well, I just assumed that they were being looked after okay, and they were. And I said to the chap, well, what's going on? I don't understand. Where were we going? He said, going? He said, we're going to France, of course. So I said, France? Christ. Well, that was in the evening of D2, I reckon now, and we floated about in the evening, and it was night, it was late on, you see, when we actually got away, and then the next morning, well, we were floating about on the sea, and it was very rough, and the ship itself was one of these welded things, and as the wave came, it lifted up the front, and then it lifted up the middle, and the front went down, and the back was down, and then the back went up, and the middle went down. Well, you never seen it. It was like a snake going across the sea, you see. And all the time it was going like this, because it had got my 16 Cromwells on board, and a whole lot of soft vehicles on as well. And I thought, well, if we get to the other side, I reckon we'll be somewhat fortunate. However, it didn't seem to break, and but it just creaked all the time. The noise was terrific, really. Anyway, as we were going along during the day, the sea was quite sort of rough, you know. Swell. There was a big swell on it, you know. And I can remember hearing distantly a sort of boom, boom, bang, boom, like this going on, sort of grumbly noise, like thunder. And as we went on, so this thunder seemed to get a bit louder, you see, and I thought, well, I don't know. Well, anyway, I didn't want to think too much. I went down and got the blokes, and saw my men, and said they'd better clean the tanks and make sure they were okay, and generally sort of gave them a few jobs to do. And then, of course, we had another night. The dark came again. By this time, the thunder was getting much louder. And then I can remember very early in the morning, it was first light, we looked out, and there were ships all over the place, all round us, and the noise was terrific. And There was a battleship, I'm not quite sure what its name was, but there was a battleship on our left, and this thing was firing with all guns at once. I mean, you have never... Why they fire them all at once? They said something, one of the chaps was saying to me, there seemed to be some reason for doing it. Apparently, if they don't fire them all at once, it bends it or does something to it. I don't know what it does, but you have never seen anything like it. Huge, great black clouds of smoke with a great big red flame, and you could actually see the shells going for a fraction of a second. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes. And then we suddenly were going forward towards the shore. And then I looked over on the side, and there were hundreds of blokes floating face down. They were RAF regiment chaps. Well, I didn't really like that much, so I went to the other side of the ship to sort of look over the other side so I wasn't looking at it, and there were even more there. In the meantime, I might tell you, the ship's officers were not talking to me at all. I mean, they just ignored me completely. I mean, they just, I don't know what they were doing, but they were. Anyway, the next thing is that the thing's sort of jolting about, and we're right on the shore, and the ramp goes down, and the captain came over to me, you see, with his entourage around him, and I assume he's got a lot of gold braid on anyway, and he said, well, get your effing tanks off here a bit quicker, I don't want to be here. So I said no, okay, so right, so you see, well, actually I thought to myself, well, I don't want to be here either, you see. Anyway, I said to my bloke, right, by this time we'd unhitched the chains off the tanks, and I said to the first tank, righto, off you go, down the ramp, you see. Well, obviously, he was to go down the ramp, and we'd waterproof them so that they would go through about 6 or 8 foot of water at the worst. Well, in fact, it went down the ramp, and it just kept on going, and suddenly you could see the underside of it, and it just flopped over upside down, complete with the blokes, of course, and disappeared because the water closed over the top of it, you see. And I couldn't believe it. I was absolutely astounded, you see. And suddenly this captain came over to me, and he started to go at me, stupid idiot and all the rest of it, and a lot more than that. And I said, well, I don't know, I can't understand it, and all this sort of thing, you see. Well, they then couldn't get any more tanks off, so they put out a sea anchor, and they pulled on this sea anchor with the ship's engines going flat out in reverse, and to try to pull it, and of course, all of a sudden, there was a most terrific crack, and the cable of the sea anchor parted, and it came whizzing back, and all the little funnels and rails and all the rest of it on the side of the ship, which was on the other side to where we were standing, just disintegrated. It cut them off like a knife. Fortunately, there was nobody standing there. Glad it didn't come my side. Anyway, by this time, I was pretty, I was wondering what on earth I was doing there, really. I thought I would have been back at Totteridge with Mum, but it wasn't the case. In the meantime, also, I remember that there were a lot of planes, German planes, coming over. They always said that there weren't any planes, German planes. They'd been shot out of the sky. But I can quite clearly remember that we got strafed on several occasions on the beach, actually, at that time. D4, this is now, by the way.
So do you know what beach it was?
Yes, Gold Beach.
It was Gold Beach.
Yeah. Near Port-en-Besson.
Where did you find out precisely where you were?
I'll tell you afterwards. So the thing was that finally the ship pulled off, because I think it must have been on an incoming tide. You see, I think if they could do, they'd go in on the incoming tide, so they floated it off easily after they got the tanks off. So anyway, it floated away back, and then we came in again, and they put the ramp down, and the other 15 tanks went off quite successfully, me included. It was obvious that the crew didn't want to be there, And nor did we really, because it was not very good. But anyway, we got directed up into the fields very quickly. We just drove straight away, got into a field, and I suppose I'd only been in there a short time, and somebody came along and demanded the tanks, and they took the tanks away, and most of the men disappeared as well. I don't know, nobody discussed it with me at all, just took them. And I might tell you that I can remember we had tried to get our food going. We had like little metal things with a bit of camphor in, and you lit it up and put your mess tin on with a bit of water in and whatever it was, or McConaughey or a tin of something we had, and made a bit of tea and a bit of hot food. And I was fiddling about doing this sort of thing and walking about in this field and talking to some of the men, and suddenly there was a sort of hissing noise, you know, like bzz, bzz, like bees it was really, and I couldn't understand what this was. And the next minute, over the top of the trees came a Messerschmitt 109, absolutely flat out at 0 feet, the height of those trees, you see. And right behind it was a Spitfire firing at him, hammering like hell at this thing. And right behind him came a Messerschmitt 109, hammering like hell at the Spitfire. And right behind him came another Spitfire hammering, there were four of them. And of course, you can't imagine, I mean, that was one of my lives gone for a Burton, because I'd been standing in the overrun of the bullets, and that's what the hissing noise was. Not one touched me, so him up there must have been very decent. Very shortly after that, then I was told to report to a jeep came and picked me up and drove me off. Or was it a motorbike? Jeep, I think it was. And off I went, and suddenly I was with a chap called John Semkin, Major Semkin, and well, actually he was a captain at that time, Captain Semkin, and they had Shermans, and I hadn't really seen Shermans before. We had them at Sandhurst, a few, but only just a little short go on them. Mainly we'd been on the Cromwells, but anyway, there were Shermans there, and this John Semkin, Captain Semkin, was very, very nice to me and said, "Oh, good. Well, okay, if you'd like to see, this is Lieutenant Fern, Neville Fern. You'll be under instruction with him, and he'll tell you what's to go on and so on." So I duly shook hands and met him, and they got a brew of tea going, sort of thing, and they allocated me to a tank, and the tank was it seemed to be okay, and I had a look around it and met the crew and the driver and so on, and the wireless operator, and then I thought, well, the next thing was, it was dark and we had to keep down, and the next morning we were up bright and sparky early, sort of thing, and Neville Fern, I was with him, stayed with him and with his troop. My tank, incidentally, was called AIM. It was a diesel Mark IV Sherman and 75 gun. And I was with him, and we were at Saint-Pierre there, and there was a certain amount of firing, and they fired back. I didn't fire my tank much. I didn't seem to see much to look at. I couldn't quite understand what they were firing at, but they seemed to be, you know. And he was talking to me over the air, and then he got out and we talked to each other on the ground. And during the day, I noticed that when we did fire the gun, I really wasn't quite sure where my rounds went to. And it just sort of, you know, it was the most odd sort of feeling. So, that was the end of that day. I decided that I'd have a look through the periscope of the gun and also take out the firing pin and have a look through the barrel. Well, it looked to me as if the barrel was aiming at the sky when I was looking through the periscope at the hedge road not very far away, you see. So I then did what we call T&A, which was, of course, to get a bit of grass and grease to form a cross T on the end of the barrel. There are actual marks on the end of the gun barrel. And, the thing was hopelessly out. I mean, the gun was up in the air and the blooming sights were down there. How the previous bloke had handled it, I don't know. So anyway, we T&A'd the sights. The gunner wasn't very pleased with me at all about this. I had a Sergeant Jackson, who was a chap who was 40 years of age, I might tell you, and he was very, very au fait with me. He didn't, well, you can't blame them because they'd been in the desert, a lot of these chaps. They used a lot of desert terms, I might tell you, like Marlish and Mushyas and Kwaskatir and things like that. Kwaskatir means excellent, and Egyptian words, because they'd been in the desert, you see, the Sherwood Rangers. And I knew these words from my brother, actually, who was also in the desert, and or some of them. And so it felt like home. As far as the crews were concerned, my particular crew, they sort of were... Well, they just didn't sort of say much, really. We weren't unfriendly, and yet they weren't friendly. They were all right. But, of course, think of it for a moment. A young boy aged 19 being put into a position whereby he was going to tell people who'd been right the way through the desert, right the way through training in England, D-Day, and then, okay, 3 or 4 days after D-Day, there he is telling you what to do, which you can understand was a big undertaking, really, from the point of view of the men to stomach that. I did actually ask my wireless operator what he thought about all this afterwards, and he said, well, in view of the fact that the casualties were so terrific amongst the troop leaders and the crew commanders, he said, and generally speaking, we used to feel sorry for you. That was his way of summing it up. Anyway, the thing was that on the next day, I was then in charge of... I had one day under instruction. The first day we were actually in action, but the next day I was actually under instruction. I was under instruction for the first day, and the next day, that was it. So I had one day of training as a troop leader in action. And then I had my own troop, three tanks, Sergeant Jackson and a corporal.
And all three tanks were standard Sherman tanks? Yes. You didn't have any Firefly at that stage?
Not at that stage, no.
And how did you find being in action? What was your first response to it?
The first thing was that John Semkin was a very cool character. And a very nice character. He was aloof, and yet, friendly. It was difficult to sum up how he could be the same, but he was. You had the feeling, for instance, when you were advancing, that he was watching you all the time. But in fact, I subsequently found out that he wasn't at all. He was actually map reading very, very accurately. And he would say, can you see the house on your right with the pond outside it? Yes. Well, get to the left of that if you... can you get round to the left of that? Okay, well, that's where you want to be. Go there. Oh, right, I'll go round to that. That sort of situation. In fact, he bred confidence.